in New York.
In the state of Mississippi, many years ago, a boy of 14 years got a taste of Southern law. He saw his friend a-hanging, his color was his crime, and the blood upon his jacket put a brand upon his mind. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. His name was Medgar Evers, and he walked his road alone, like Emmett Till and thousands more whose names we'll never know. They tried to burn his home and they beat him to the ground, but deep inside they both knew what it took to bring him down. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. The killer waited by his home, hidden by the night, as Evers stepped out from his car into the rifle sight. He slowly squeezed the trigger, the bullet left his side. It struck the heart of every man whenever Evers fell and died. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. And they laid him in his grave while the bugle sounded clear. Laid him in his grave when the victory was near. While we waited for the future, for freedom through the land, the country gained a killer and the country lost a man. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. Oh, let it never be again.
WBAI, New York. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, solo for the first time, Mercurio David Rivera. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. And The Mortal Instruments, City of Bones, has made it into theaters. It did crap at the box office, which is just as well because it was a lousy film. So let's not talk about it anymore. Let's talk instead about The World's End. Yeah, that's better. Quite a bit better, actually. This has been dubbed the third installment of what's being called the Three Flavors Cornetto Trilogy, one of those trilogies where everybody tells the creators, director Edgar Wright, star and co-writer Simon Pegg, and co-star Nick Frost, the people say, you've got a trilogy here, and the creators say, okay, yeah, sure, it's a trilogy. Now, between the first two films, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, and this one, there is a sort of consistent attitude and outlook, even though it's not the same characters and certainly not the same storyline. So take that as it is. Anyway, in The World's End, five friends, played by Pegg, Frost, Patty Considine, Eddie Marson, and Martin Freeman, yes, Bilbo himself, or if you prefer, Dr. Watson, reunite in their small hometown to reenact an epic pub crawl they attempted in their teen years. In the first attempt at knocking off 12 pubs in one night, they did not get to the finish line. The pub called The World's End. But now their former leader, Gary, played with type A avidity by Simon Pegg in an apparently self-delusional haze of heroic nostalgia, insists they try again, and the friends, with no little reluctance, accede. So we've got the setting for comedy in the You Can't Go Home Again mold, which Wright is initially willing to indulge, all the way to showing that awkward moment when people view their hometown through eyes a little older, if not necessarily wiser, and also with sly digs at the franchising of the neighborhood bar experience. But as with their previous films, Wright and Pegg are never far away from their geekish instincts, starting with Gary's desperately theatrical attempts to style this crawl as a grand quest just short of the Fellowship of the Ring. The casting of Freeman has several levels to it, turns out, with those instincts fully blossoming not too far into the crawl, when the friends realize that a fair portion of their discomfort comes from the fact that most of the people in their old hometown have been replaced by robots. Here's the crux of the Wright-Pegg approach. Take real people mired in real-world concerns and throw them into situations that are not just fantastical, but play as the concatenation of every geekish obsession that ever existed. Star Wars, E.T., Doctor Who, Marvel comic books, you name it. To the film's benefit, both human and robots acknowledge the situation early on. To its detriment, that raises the problem of why Gary insists that the crawl be continued regardless. Wright and Pegg throw up several explanations, some obvious straw men, some more credible, but the real reason, the one that casts Gary in a new light and lends some depth to a person who to that point had been intentionally portrayed as a walking cartoon, of necessity, that reason is held to the final act. It lands effectively and well sets up the film's final confrontation, but it does mean you spend the bulk of the film thinking that these guys should just get their butts back in the car and get the hell out of town. The World's End is not quite successful in its ambitions. Wright and Pegg work some novel wrinkles and motivations into the standard robot invasion scenario, and they are specialists at the discordant collision of the real and the fantastic. But here the gears really grind, noticeably. That doesn't mean that the film isn't frequently quite funny and that the characters aren't fun to hang out with. Meanwhile, the notion of the uneasy intrusion of ordinary mortals into a world of robots, like a happy-faced version of the Borg, these bots are perfectly fine with trespassers so long as they don't make waves. That makes for some nicely unsettling comedy. It isn't the perfect closing chapter to the trilogy, but like the films that precede it, it is an appealing attempt to instill some genuine heart into satirical comedy. I'm Dan Persons. Find out more about the world of fantastic film and TV at Cinefantastique Online over at cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan Persons. So, that was a movie I'm, you know, I want to see it. And Dan says, oh, in an email, oh, don't worry. There isn't any gore. Well, a few beheadings. You know, that, you know, yes, I do find that disturbing. I don't know why other people wouldn't find that disturbing, but, you know, to me, the last movie I would ever see is Cabin in the Woods. Is it well written? Yes. Is it well directed? Yes. I have no doubt of that. Joss Whedon and all that stuff. But I just don't go in for these things that give me... I mean, even Monty Python and the Holy Grail... In one of the funniest scenes where they're cutting off the guy's, you know, arms and legs, and he's saying, yo, come back here, I'll bite off your gonads. It's a hilarious scene, but I have dreams about it that are not good dreams. That's
not entertainment.
Having said that, I have seen Hot Fuzz, which was the second movie in that trilogy. And I loved it. And I generally like Simon Pegg films. I liked his TV series, Spaced, which I thought was really good. And I'm really curious about, and Martin Freeman, come on, I called out Martin Freeman even before, what is it I saw him in? Something before Sherlock.
Have you seen World's End?
No, well, that's what we're talking about.
Oh, okay, yes, yes. I saw it last week. It was wonderful. A little bit absurdist.
Well, thank you. You know, absurdist is what I want.
Yes, but it starts off quite, you know, like a realistic yarn. Some guys reliving their childhood.
Their great pub crawl.
Yeah, and it's actually quite humorous, realistic, and then it just takes a sharp turn into absurdity and spec fic.
Yeah, well, you see, I love that. I love that. I love Edgar Wright as a director, even though I only somewhat loved, what was the film he made with Michael Cera? The big graphic novel...
Oh, yes, I can't think of it.
Video game winner, and he has to battle his wannabe girlfriend's ex-lovers.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I like his writing. I love Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, especially as a duo. It's like Fry and Laurie.
Yes. I mean, Simon Pegg is hilarious. Even in Star Trek, he was hilarious.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's not a good fit as Scotty. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter because he's in the film, and that makes it good. I don't know what that thing is that accompanies him throughout both Star Trek movies.
Yeah, I think it's hilarious myself.
No, it's funny, but it. What is it? Why is it there? I think that's the point, actually. Mm-hmm. Was just, you know, Abrams having a lark on us or something. Yeah. It'll probably, you know, turn out to be... I don't know. I have problems with. Let's not talk movies all night. Mercurio David Rivera, sometimes called David Rivera, sometimes called Evil David, sometimes called Mercurio.
Yes, sometimes Mercurio D. Rivera, which is
that's right.
Yes, which is the writing name.
Yes. Yes, but the birth certificate would say what? Mercurio David?
No, it would just say David Rivera.
Really?
Really, and the reason for that is because. If you Google David Rivera, you'd get thousands of hits,
yeah.
None of which would be me, many of which would be sex offenders.
Right.
And
yeah.
As a result, in order to find...
But if I put in Mercurio, I get stuff about Romeo and Juliet, so...
But if you put Mercurio Rivera, you get me.
That's
the idea.
Exactly. Yeah. So, where did that name come from? Did you choose that name?
Well, you know, I have an uncle who's named Saturno. Believe it or not.
Ooh,
and,
that's a great name.
It is a great name, and I didn't want to just steal it. So I figured, let me pick another planet and use the Spanish pronunciation.
Oh.
So I went with Mercurio.
Okay. So I assume, I've never asked you this, known you years, that there is some kind... Yeah, isn't that wonderful? You can do a whole... When Daniel Jose Older was here, and I told him, put on your headphones, and he heard that sound,
yeah.
His reaction was to start... using that sound, you know? you know, that bong that these cheap bleep microphones. Where's the list? We have a list of the seven words you can't say, and they're numbered. So I think it's number one. I think the S word is number
best
one.
Best not to see the list. It just, you know, encourages you to say
well,
the words.
Except that. I am in... our program director has so much on his hands. so much on his hands. I mean, God knows where it even begins. He'll be on the air here at 5, by the way. Hello, Andrew, if you're listening. And one thing I want to, assuming we survive, knock wood, assuming we survive, I want to talk to him about why can't we do the 7 words during what is called safe harbor. From 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., the reason we lost the Carlin case was because it was a Saturday at 2 p.m. But based on an episode of Hour of the Wolf, featuring a Mr. Harlan something.
Oh, I've heard of that guy, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Where we broadcast his reading of Story Shatterday, which he had written the day before. That was the test case for the Carlin decision. And the point was, okay, we lost because it was broadcast at a time when children would be listening. What are they doing listening at 5 a.m.?
Right. Have there been any subsequent rulings dealing with that issue?
Yes. We won.
Okay.
Or rather, we didn't win. The Justice Department told the FCC to lay off, in essence, and the case was not pursued. I had been suspended.
Mm.
And the station had been given another, you're going back to the Supreme Court, which cost the station $2 million to go there in the first place. Although, from what I understand, we may not have paid that bill in full.
Okay. We better keep that to ourselves.
Yeah, except the lawyers who handled it became famous for handling our case, and everybody approved of the job they did.
Mm.
And now they represent CBS and Fox and this and that. So I don't think they're happy they didn't get paid, but on the other hand, they made their name. They were pretty good before us, but after us, they were famous.
Mm.
So anyway, yes, it was determined that between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., children should not be unsupervised. They should not be listening to the radio if they are too young to understand the words. The following program contains frank language. If you're offended by frank language, bleep you. which we actually did once as a disclaimer. No, that wasn't quite proper, but that was also before the Carlin case. But anyway.
So we can just cut loose, in other words.
Well, if you're reading a story, you can't just say bleep you on the air.
Mm-hmm.
But if a character in a story says, bleep you, in the context of the story, yes, you can.
Hmm.
But Pacifica is very, very wary. Pacifica's in so much in debt that even if they're sure that we could win the case, they don't want the case.
Hmm.
So, but Andrew Phillips is fully aware of the idea of safe harbor. So I'm going to let, and he feels as I do about it. So I'm going to let him debate it with Pacifica. He's paid by Pacifica. He represents Pacifica here.
Okay.
So, but, it's going to be at a time after it's determined whether we're going to survive past February or not.
Okay.
So, getting back, you've been on this show how many times?
Oh, boy, I'd say, is it perhaps 6 times?
Yeah, it's
around that time.
I was going to say 5 or 6. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but this is the first time I'm here by myself. It's previously been with my writer's group.
Altered Fluid.
Altered Fluid, and each time we've done a on-air live critique of a...
Well, one was recorded.
Story. True, yes.
One was recorded in a downtown office. But the others were all live on the air, and I so prefer...
Yeah, no, those were great experiences. I remember I read one of my stories on the air and wound up revising it and selling it.
Yeah.
And it's now in my collection.
It is. And but the name changed.
Yes.
And it's now called, which one?
It's The Fifth Z.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, when I read it on the air, it was The Fifth Daniel.
That's what it was.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Right. And, I had that air check. And maybe one day we'll get you to read The Fifth Z on the air.
Ah, okay.
And do a comparison of the two. I once had Carol Emschwiller on 3 times in 1 year. And we followed the genesis of a story she was writing from very first rough draft to polished work to published work. And they were three different stories. And each one was rather different. Hmm. And M. Schwiller, she's a great writer.
Oh, yeah.
So that was fascinating. And I would love to, like, listen to rebroadcast the story with the crits, which are critiques, everybody.
Yeah.
That the writers group, which basically reads the story and then goes around the room with a little timer and, you know, say yays and nays and here's a point and nitpicks and stuff like that. I would call them nits rather than crits. And
sometimes they're crits.
Sometimes they're crits. I remember one person in the group, their story was just, I was astounded at, like, you know, you got that so wrong. How could you get that so wrong? And I won't name.
Yeah. Yeah, but we always try to keep it positive, though. You know, we always try to put it in terms of it, this can be better in the following ways.
It was exactly. Yeah. It was positive in the sense that you're trying to make it better.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I thought of an old joke that most writers love. Okay, very quickly. A writer is sitting at a stream, and he's drinking the water, and an editor comes along and pees into the stream. And the writer said, "Why did you do that?" And the editor said, "I'm only trying to make it better." This is definitely a pro-writer, anti-editor joke. Most writers I have told this to think it's hilarious. One editor, who we all know, who I will not name, thought she thought it was not funny at all.
Okay.
And I can understand why. It's really an anti-editor story, but a writer's group can be a little bit like that.
It can be. You know, it's been such a positive experience for me. Honestly, I've got to say that my stories always improve after I run them through the group,
yeah,
without fail.
Now, this group, you were really the genesis of your collection Across the Event Horizon from, I never remember the name of the publisher.
Newcon Press.
Yes, which actually published the book first in England.
Yes.
The genesis of this book... You're becoming a professional writer. And the genesis of the group, I would say, are somewhat intertwined. Is that not true?
That's actually pretty fair, yes, because the introduction to the book is by science fiction writer Terry Bisson.
Yeah.
And Terry, of course...
Fellow's been on the show no less than 15 times, but...
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yes, before he turned traitor and moved to San Francisco. anybody's a traitor who moves out of New York. And then when they come back, like last week's guest, William Shun, it's like, oh, no, you weren't a traitor at all. Chicago, give me a break. Second city.
Well, the genesis of the group is that all of us were in Terry Bisson's science fiction writing course taught at the New School. And folks decided to stay together after that class ended. And that formed the core group of Altered Fluid. And I actually took Terry's class the subsequent year, and then I heard about this group that existed from his from the previous year and joined it. And we've been together since 2001 or 2002 mm-hmm. or so. So it's been around a while, and I joined in 2004. So it's been quite a while.
Yeah. I'm aware of one group that is older. Why is the name's like Circle in the Hair, something like that? Yeah, I think
I
that's
heard
it.
That group. So,
yeah, yes, Linda Addison, okay. And who's about to leave New York in September.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she's moving to the Midwest, not Midwest, like Santa Fe area.
Okay.
So I have to get her on the air before she moves. This another traitor. Anyway. Yeah, but I just remembered that I have to make room for her in our schedule. But anyway.
So the stories in this collection all were run through the writers group.
Yeah.
And the writers group was formed by taking Terry Bisson's class, and Terry Bisson did the introduction to the collection. So it all kind of came together in one big circle.
Yeah. And he's a master, I think, of the short story. He's written a few novels, and I consider them good. But I consider most of his short stories brilliant.
Oh, yes. No doubt about it.
I mean, including a few stories that he sort of, I wouldn't say that he's disowned, but I thought his one story called Max, M-A-C-S.
I've read that, yes.
Was a devastatingly brilliant story. Mm. And it touches nerves as well it should.
Yeah.
And I think that I understand why he doesn't necessarily promote that story so much. You can't find it online anymore, even though I think it was originally published online.
Yeah, you know, I think it was in collected in one of the year's best. I think that's where I read
I'm sure it was. Yeah. I'm sure it was. So, M-A-C-S by Terry Bisson, B-I-S-S-O-N. People should look out for that. And if you like Terry Bisson's writing, and you will, then you will like Across the Event Horizon, which is, I would say, the two of you belong in the same subgenre, which I don't want to use the word interstitial. I don't, it's not science fiction. It's not fantasy. It's, yes, it's speculative fiction, but spec fic sort of means to people a particular subgenre in and of itself.
Right.
Even though it's a term coined by Robert Heinlein in 1946, people think it's this new touchy-feely thing. No. Comes from Astounding. Huh. Heinlein coined it.
Well, I'll tell you, to hear my name mentioned in the same sentence as Terry Bisson is quite an honor. But I'll tell you what, Jim, in terms of the way that I construct my stories, I would say I owe it completely to Terry Bisson, because he has a very mechanical approach to story construction. Which is, you know, you come up with your basic premise, your MacGuffin, your central idea to the story, and then you just do scene, the middle, beginning, I mean, the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Very mechanical.
Yeah.
And that's the approach that I take.
Although your stories tend to run longer than his.
True.
His tend to be pastiches.
True.
They tell their bit, they make their point, and then he gets the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Krasnoff, who's in a different writer's group.
Mm-hmm.
Currently called Tabula Rasa. She does the same kind of thing. She writes small, little pieces, and they sort of end on the punchline.
Right.
And then she's out of there. Your stories flow. You maybe your approach is the same, but the flow of your story, I'm saying this as a reader, to me, is a little more, I don't know, organic?
No, I think that's fair. My stories tend to run in the 6,000 to 7,000 word range, which is much longer than Terry's work.
Yeah,
no doubt about
that. In general, yeah. And you play with language a little more. I mean, especially the story Double.
Oh yes.
I should say this off the air, not on the air. That is a story to do as for radio. It is so, and you know, using the left and the right channel.
Right.
Left. It's it's perfect for audio. It really is. It just uses language. It uses the imagination. It's not quite tongue twisters, but it comes close.
I had a lot of fun with that one. No question about it.
Especially, I had a lot of fun reading it.
Especially during the revision process, trying to come up with double phrases. Words that repeat, like couscous.
Yeah. And it would be, it's been a while since I read it, so I would have to. But you play with form, and that's part of it. You know, by the way, I shouldn't diss the book. I like books of collections. Mm-hmm. When they have multiple short stories, it says on every page on the header, left page, Mercurio de Rivera. On the right page, Across the Event Horizon. I like it when they give the name of the story.
Yeah.
I know it says Across the Event Horizon on the cover.
Right. I mean left.
Yeah, exactly. upper right, actually, in this case. Because that way I can leaf through faster and find, you know, favorite passage or something
Right.
like that. Especially when you're talking about a short story collection.
Mm-hmm.
I like it that way.
Yeah. But you're right. I do like playing with language. And there's a story in there called Tu Sufrimiento Shall Protect Us.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is written, it was inspired by Gino Diaz's Pulitzer Prize winning novel, the name of which escapes me right now.
Had I not been trying to think of it, I probably could have come up
yeah,
with
it. Oscar Wilde, is it? Oscar? I can't think of it. But,
yeah.
But in any event, he uses a lot of Spanglish in his writing, and I thought, wow, what mm-hmm. a great idea. I'm going to just try that myself. So I try to mix in a lot of Spanish phrases into mm-hmm. the story, and with the idea being that you can figure out what it means from the context.
Yeah.
You know.
So, or if you know Spanish.
Or if you know Spanish.
Yeah.
It's an advantage.
There's that, yes. it's a wonderful collection, and it is so, I mean, it's rare, very rare, that a writer of short stories can debut with a collection. Most people, they can sell 25 stories, they can be celebrated, they can get honorable mentions in the year's best, or even sell, be reprinted in the year's best, but they can't get a book out of it.
Mm. Well, thanks for the compliment, Jim, by the way. That's very kind of you, and I'm certainly honored that Ian Waits, the editor of the book, approached me with the idea. I mean, he had solicited a story from me for his upcoming Solaris Rising 2 anthology.
Ah.
And I sent him a story. He loved it. He took it. And then a few weeks later, he just followed up and said, hey, any interest in putting out a collection? And I said, duh, yes, of course.
Yeah, duh is the correct answer.
Yeah.
Because you're very both lucky in that regard, but you earned it.
Mm.
Because the stories are they're just fun. They're my, well, there's a lot of things that are my kind of skiffy, my kind of genre story, which is the best word I can put to what you write.
Mm.
I don't know what it is. I'll call it genre. but it's the kind that I love, where I can read it. And I was complaining before about movies that give me a bad feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Your stories give me a good feeling. They're engaging. They're great to read on a reader in your bed or with a book light, since we're actually talking about it here. My reader, my e-reader can't do that. And can't get, yeah, you have to autograph this, by the way. I got this at the launch party.
Oh, okay.
But you were busy. You were busy, so I have to get this autographed.
Yes, and I understand that you walked away from that party with a special gift from a famous editor.
I
So you not only did you get a book, but you got a...
Is that the one who didn't like the joke?
I think so.
I got a cotton candy making machine. Which is very bizarre on the basis that I'm a diabetic. But my partner, Barbara, is thrilled by it. We have used it once when a whole bunch of what they would call in Spanish or mishpacha or some other language came over. And also we have occasional, you know, get-togethers of friends, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And... That's why she chose us as the victims. Her place is just filled with awards. If you've ever been there, she has awards, books, and cats. And
so something had to go, and it was the cotton candy.
And it was the cotton candy machine. And I don't even remember how she got it. I'm gonna have to ask her.
Well, imagine my surprise when the book party was in a small pub. Down in the village. And,
not that small.
It was a nice place. Yeah, you're right. It was a very nice place. But I received a call from the owner, and he said, somebody's trying to install a cotton candy machine. Do you know anything about this? And I didn't. I said, I don't know, but that's fine by me. And I came to learn that it was this this editor.
It's
acclaimed editor.
Ellen Datlow, everybody.
Yes, it's Ellen Datlow.
It's Ellen Datlow. She was on the show last month. Everybody knows, you know, she does the other reading series. I do one reading series. She and Matt Kressel do the other reading series.
Yes, I've heard of that guy, Kressel.
Yeah. I have to promote my reading series. Mm-hmm. It's starting again. We actually, unlike the KGB Fantastic Fiction series that just goes year-round, we do seasons, which means I get a break. But we're coming back September 10th with Mr. Richard Bowes.
Oh, I've heard of that guy,
Rick
too.
Bowes, yes. Who's been around, especially on the air. And he will be on the air again September. I actually have a show Thursday morning, September 11th. And so we will be broadcasting again his short story, There's a Hole in the City.
Fantastic.
Because rituals must be obeyed, and Rick did a wonderful reading of that story, which is available from WBAI as a premium. You can go to WBAI.org and order a copy right now, or you can just tune in September 11th and hear it for free. But you need to donate money to the station, so you should do it that way. Also, I've ordered 30 copies for Rick because he donated his reading and his work to us, and I think he deserves 30 copies
great.
To do whatever.
That's great. It's a fantastic story. I love that story. And, you know, Rick Bowes and Matt Kressel are both members of Altered Fluid.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, Rick actually belongs to both Altered Fluid and Tabula Rasa.
What's this? Wait a second. This is not allowed. No, I'm just
kidding. Yeah, right.
Kidding.
you think? It's like, but I mean, that and Altered Fluid, you're not meeting weekly anymore, are you?
We're not. There was a time there where we met. I remember one time we met about 7 or 8 consecutive weeks in a row.
Yeah.
We were producing that many stories. But a lot of the members now are working on novels. And as a result of that, I'd say we're meeting now close to once every 3 weeks.
It's hard for writers' groups to analyze novels. Because what do? Chapter by chapter?
Yeah,
how do you get the form in there?
We won't do that. I mean, the way we
the
do it
The other
writers, is,
Tabula Rasa, won't either.
No, the way we do it is you have to submit the entire book. And then we spend the whole session just reviewing that book in its entirety.
Because
otherwise you start saying, well, it depends on where the story's going, and, you know.
Whereas the other writers group, Circle in the Hair, they actually do novels.
Okay.
But they're also a small closed group. I think they're like 4 or 5 people. But they've been around for like 25 years.
Wow. Okay.
They really have. They're hardworking people. They're all good writers. But I don't want to talk about them too much because I don't. The only person who's ever admitted on the air were both Gerard Juaner and Linda Addison. Mm. So I don't even know who the others are. Or I did, but it doesn't matter. But I'm fascinated by writers' groups, which is why I like having Altered Fluid on the air. We're going to do it again.
Yes, we have to return.
And if we move to 388 Atlantic Avenue in time, I want to do it on the bleeping roof. We have a roof with an apiary, a garden. There's a garden there. And yes, you'll hear the traffic. I don't care.
I'm not sure if that's a good idea, Rick. I mean, you have these despondent authors getting critiqued and we're on a rooftop. I don't know.
It's got it's got protection.
Oh, okay.
Actually, we have to. The owner of the building, the current owner of the building, is like putting up little barriers so we can actually have like concerts and things like that up there.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, it's a lovely space. It feels like a community space. The soundproofing is awful, but hey, everybody, listen to the sound here. You know, so it'll be problematic there, but and we're so grateful for City College for renting us the space that we're in inexpensively. But this place at 388 Atlantic Avenue feels like home. Mm. I haven't felt like that since the WBAI church on 6. We owned a church.
Really? I didn't know this.
Yes. Yeah, we owned a large, full church at 359 East 62nd Street. I still have this fantasy that if I press this button over here, the on-air lights will go. People's apartments now will go light on, go on and off, warning them. But I begrudge the sale of that building. But that's a story that goes back to 1977, much of which can be seen in the movie Radio Unnameable, which played recently on PBS.
Okay.
And is available online, I think, at radiounnameable.com.
Hmm.
And some of that covers, it's all about Bob Fass. And some of that covers the 77 incident. Anyway, getting back from the writers group, let's reel it back, and it's already 2:08. How long is the reading you're going to do for us?
It's about, I would say about 20 minutes.
Yeah. So we should probably get to that soon.
Okay.
Take a break of music first, I think.
That's a good idea.
For a breather, do you have any requests?
No.
Okay, let me see. I have to, I do this all online now. So I can choose, like, any song in the world.
Oh, wow.
And it's really great. But, of course, I have to sign into the service. You know what? I'm going to play one of my old standbys. Why not? I actually do have... Come on. Where are you? There's a folder open. Here we go. Nah, not the Highwayman. What do you think? Come Take a Trip on My Airship or Journey of the Sorcerer?
Airship.
Airship. Very good. Natalie Merchant, everybody, and we'll be back shortly.
I once loved a sailor. Once a sailor loved me. But he was not a sailor who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing. And every evening at midnight, he would come to my window and sing. Come take a trip in my airship, come sail away to the stars. We'll travel to Venus, we'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're kissing, no one will know as we swoon. So come take a trip in my airship, and we'll visit the man in the moon. Sailing away from the crowds, we passed through the milky white way. While idly drifting, watching the clouds, he asked if I'd name the day. Just by the dipper, I gave him my heart. The sun shone on our honeymoon. We swore to each other we never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my airship.
Come sail away to the stars.
We'll travel to Venus.
We'll sail away to Mars.
No one will see while we're
It's a 1911 song. I found a 1911 version of it. It sounds awful. I mean, it's like you're probably from a cylinder, you know, wax cylinder. So it's very, very difficult to listen to, but it's by the author of the song.
Wow.
But the Natalie Merchant version of the song is just wonderful, which is what we just heard.
Yeah.
And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Mercurio D. Rivera is the byline. David Rivera is actually the name. I've never asked, by the way, where Evil David comes from. We're going to do that later, maybe. I forgot to mention that on September 10th at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, there's this other guy who's going to read with Rick Bowes named Michael Swanwick. Who has lost more awards than anybody living. That's why I, because when Swanwick was last year, I pointed out that he was not between the Hugo, the Nebula, and the World Fantasy Award. He has been nominated more than anybody ever.
Unbelievable.
And he said, that means also, by the way, that I have lost more. Well, even to Michael to figure that one out, you know.
That's a half glass empty, I guess, view of things.
Yeah, listeners, I'll tell you how to look up Swanwick. Just Google Michael Swanwick. He's a wonderful writer. So that's September 10th, Tuesday, September 10th at the Soho Gallery for Digital Arts at 138 Sullivan Street between Houston and the Priest and the street formerly known as Prince. And it starts at 7. The doors open at 6:30. We serve cider. Come early. Come often. It's admission is free. Anybody who gives a donation on the way in, which we, you know, strongly encourage, gets a raffle ticket to win some autographed books. So we started that some months ago. It seems to be very popular. Huh. The idea of having this raffle for donations, and you know, it can be a quarter, it can be a nickel. It's just donate anything. And you'll get a raffle ticket. That's all. You know, admission is free, but God knows how much money I've sunk into this darn thing. And now I'm actually going to put somebody on salary. But that's another story. Our guest, as mentioned, is, to find out more, go to ourwolf.com and look for the thingy that says New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and which will also have links, by the way, to the KGB Fantastic Fiction Readings. As I like to say, a great reading, a great science fiction reading in New York every fortnight. Which is because we're the first week and they're the third week. So we try to space it out. And the Kindred readings aren't quite regular yet. Jen Brissett is trying to do that, and hopefully she will succeed as she starts up her new season.
Yeah.
Hell, maybe if she can do it at 388 Atlantic. That would be, I'm serious. That would be nice. That would be a good location. But anyway, yes. Okay, so the book is Across the Event Horizon, and you have a short story in there.
I do.
Many short stories. One of them in particular we're going to hear.
This is true.
Ooh. But before you start, I am going to turn off the fan and seal the door so that we actually have a semblance of radio silence. So I did that without headphones. Was it successful? Okay. Yeah, it sounds better.
Okay, that sounds great. So if you're a fan of interdimensional stories, I think that you'll enjoy this one. The title of this is called Snatch Me Another. And it was reprinted in Rich Horton's collection, The Web's Best Science Fiction and Fantasy. I forget the year now, a couple years ago. Okay, Snatch Me Another. Lindy sat in her compact pickup truck, took a deep whiff of Inbliss, and tossed aside the spent plastic inhaler. She rested her forehead against the cold steering wheel. A blue-tinted circular portal the size of a manhole cover opened up over the passenger seat, and a thin, bare arm descended from it. She recognized the limb's freckled pale skin, the small scar on the inner wrist, her own arm. The hand groped blindly until it grabbed the inhaler, then retracted. The portal disc closed with a pop. Take it, Lindy muttered. It's empty anyway. She stared at the front door of her red brick colonial. The buzz started to kick in, and calm fell over her like a warm shawl. She left the truck door open and staggered down the gravel pathway and up the porch stairs. Lindy jammed her hand into the pocket of her jeans, fumbling for the house key. As she stood on the welcome mat, she heard the television blasting, frenetic munchkins singing Follow the Yellow Brick Road, and the white noise of chattering children. She stabbed at the keyhole and missed three times, but the door swung open. "Mommy," Tommy said. He wore a bright blue birthday hat over a patch of curly red hair. "Look what I got." He held up two identical G.I. Joe dolls. For a second, Lindy felt nothing but pure love, but then the glow faded to a muted sadness. "That's nice, dear," she mumbled. "Go play with your friends." She stepped around him through the throng of shouting six-year-olds, beyond the swinging door that led from the shag-carpeted living room to the bright kitchen. She leaned against the Formica counter to regain her balance. Christina sat at the table, scooping strawberry ice cream onto white paper plates. She paused, blew a dangling strand of brown hair out of her eyes, and glanced at Lindy warily. "Nice of you to show up," Christina said. Tommy's been asking for you." How did she slip back into the role of house mom without missing a goddamn beat, Lindy thought. How could it be so easy for her? "Are you okay?" Christina asked. "Just peachy." "We need some more plates. Could you snatch me some?" Christina grabbed a dirty paper dish with a curlicued happy birthday emblazoned on it, tore off a clean edge, and handed her the slip of cardboard. Lindy took long, deep breaths. "You sure you're okay?" Christina said. She snorted her assent. "Why wouldn't I be? It's a party. Let's wear our hats and sing happy birthday until our throats hurt. And let's not forget to pin the tail on the goddamn donkey." Christina looked away and continued scooping ice cream out of the frosty carton. Clutching the sliver of cardboard, Lindy lurched through the doorway that led from the kitchen into the garage. The snatcher sat next to the washing machine. Wide-mouthed and waist-high, it resembled a barrel with a glistening silver coating. If it didn't weigh so much, if it weren't so sturdy, she would have kicked the goddamn thing on its side and taken an axe to it. But what difference would that have made? Over the past 6 months, the black market had exploded. With a single phone call to Senecal, Christina could have it replaced within 24 hours. Lindy lifted the heavy metal lid and leaned in, placing the piece of the paper plate, the honing sample, at the bottom of the snatcher. She placed the cover back on and rotated a red dial on the device's side. Then she heard the familiar rumbling deep inside, like distant thunder and whooshing wind gusts, the sounds of dimensional walls crumbling. Lindy lifted the cover. The snatcher's maw released a thick blue mist. She rolled up her sleeve and bent down, sticking her arm up to her shoulder, groping blindly until she felt the paper plate. She pulled out a whole white plate with the same orange-lettered happy birthday on it. Placing and removing the lid over and over, she continued reaching in and snatching out one after another. Cake crumbs coated one plate, so she let it fall back through the base of the snatcher. When she reached in again, she felt someone slap her hand. She withdrew her arm and tried again until she had a dozen dishes in hand, perfect replicas, except for a single one with an off-white color. She imagined the reactions in the alternate dimensions. Ruining a few of those parties, she had to admit, albeit in different universes, wouldn't make her lose any sleep. When she returned to the kitchen, Tommy burst through the swinging door and hugged her leg. "Mommy, Mommy, will you play musical chairs with us?" The plates fluttered to the floor. "Mommy, will you..." "Listen," I told you to go play with your friends, okay? She pushed past the boy and trudged up the stairs. Lindy, Christina shouted after her. She paused at the top of the staircase and looked over her shoulder. Christina crouched down and comforted the crying boy. At that moment, Lindy thought she felt something again, the remnants of a maternal love so raw, so deep, it threatened to paralyze her, drown her. She reached into her jacket pocket for another inhaler and slammed the bedroom door behind her. 1 week earlier, on a chilly September morning, Lindy had leaned against a tree at the summit of a grassy hill while Father DeMichael delivered a prayer over the white oak casket, which lay wrapped in red roses and white tulips. Across from her, on the other side of the casket, Christina stood between her mother and a second Father DeMichael, who held her hand and bowed his head. No one could distinguish the original Joseph E. DeMichael, the one who had counseled Christina all her life, from the one pulled over from another reality. Lindy shivered. She'd heard rumors of people crossing over, but she'd never seen these variants before. A dozen colleagues from the car shop where Lindy worked surrounded them. Half stared at the casket, while the other half raised their eyebrows and whispered to each other, gawking at the two Father DeMichaels. Lindy turned her attention to Christina. During their intimate moments together, Lindy always playfully referred to Christina's simple girl-next-door looks as, quote, domestic sexiness. But on this day, Christina's blank, bloodshot eyes peered out from behind her tangled and unwashed hair. Until that moment, Lindy hadn't noticed her pallid face had a too thoughtful expression, a look with just a slight hint of madness. At home, she'd remained mute and blank-faced on the prescribed inhalers they were both taking, sleepwalking through her daily routines. A blue circular portal opened in midair over the coffin, and a long, bare arm reached down and plucked away a white tulip. Everyone pretended it hadn't happened. Father DeMichael, presiding over the service, cleared his throat and continued with the prayer. Lindy gazed up at two enormous, looming thunderclouds that seemed identical, with just a slit of blue sky separating them. Both appeared thick and dark gray. She focused, trying to detect the difference in the clouds' shape or size or respective shades of gray, with no success as they converged. A light drizzle began to fall. Umbrellas sprouted up around her. She continued looking skyward, enjoying the feel of the cold rain on her face. After the last of the children left the party and Christina came to bed, Lindy went into the bathroom and inhaled more in bliss. She tried to maintain her equilibrium as she wobbled back to the bed. Christina lay there with the pillow propped against her back, her reading glasses on the edge of her nose, riffling through the newspaper. Did you kiss Tommy goodnight? Lindy didn't reply. She pulled back the covers on her side of the bed and lay down. After a few minutes, Christina spoke again. Did you read today's Dear Annabelle's column? Apparently someone stole a tiny fragment of Van Gogh's Starry Night. She placed the open newspaper on her lap. There are now over 1,000 originals, and the prices are plummeting with each new one that's retrieved. And what did Dear Annabelle have to say about this? To relax, that we're living in a brand new world and have to learn to redefine our moral boundaries. Lindy grunted. Should I call Senecal and order a Starry Night? You can have it delivered first thing in the morning. I suppose it's irrelevant that Senecal is an illegal dealer, or that the Snatcher is illegal, or that every damn thing we pull out of the Snatcher is illegal. I think the painting would look fabulous in the living room. Centered over the sofa, don't you? Ever since we got the Snatcher, nothing seems to matter anymore. Senecal won't take money anymore, by the way. They want unique items they can use as honing samples. Are you even listening? Lindy asked. Christina sighed and pushed her reading glasses up the bridge of her nose. Look, there's no point fighting it. Legal or not, everyone has one by now. Even cops have their own Snatchers. We don't need a Snatch painting. There are sometimes slight differences. Imperceptible, usually. Doesn't it bother you that in 1,000 alternate universes, Van Gogh's original Starry Night is now missing? Why do you have to think about these things? Christina frowned. This is bigger than us, and all I know is we're losing things left and right in this house. This morning, my earrings got snatched, and just this afternoon, an arm swiped a $20 bill off my dresser. If other realities steal from us, then why shouldn't we steal from them? Plus, haven't you read the newspaper? Christina said. She lifted the paper from her lap. We now have all the simian flu vaccine we'll ever need. And an endless food supply to feed the hungry. What about all the other craziness, the economic crisis? It's only been 6 months since the first Natcher prototype was stolen, and now everything's spinning out of control. Can't you see that? Lindy, Christina sighed and put her hand on her shoulder. But Lindy rolled over and wrapped the covers around herself. After a long pause, Lindy whispered, How'd the kids' parents react today? They seemed fine. They were just happy to see Tommy's feeling better. Don't kid yourself. They knew. They knew when they were just being polite. Christina turned off the reading light. They lay there, back to back, in the darkness, an awkward silence filling the air before Lindsay spoke again. No starry night, okay? Christina inhaled as if to respond. Mommy, Tommy's voice squeaked from the doorway. I had a bad dream. Christina turned on the nightstand lamp and sat up. Come here, baby. Tommy ran to her and she lifted him up onto her lap. I was lost, he said, and I couldn't find you. It's okay, you're safe, she said, snuggling him. Lindy stood up and grabbed her pillow. After a few seconds, Christina said, Mommy's going to read your story, just like she always does, so you can fall back asleep. Her eyes drilled into Lindy's. Aren't you, Mommy? Lindy nodded. Can we read Thunder Bear Adventures? Tommy asked. Honey, there's no book with that title, Christina said. But it's my favorite one. Mommy always reads it to me. Lindy and Christina locked eyes again. When they had returned from the cemetery, Christina changed into her white nightgown, even though it was the middle of the afternoon. She hovered about the house aimlessly, and there was a lag in her responses to Lindy's questions, as if communicating via satellite. In a strange, flat voice, Christina announced she was going upstairs to take a nap. Lindy sat down on the living room sofa and turned on the news telecast. None of the stories registered, only random words and phrases penetrated her consciousness. Snatcher, pandemonium, markets crashing, war, variant. Lindy could only think of those final moments in the hospital. Tommy lying there unconscious, his head wrapped in bandages, his shallow breathing becoming labored and then raspy before finally ceasing. Given the circumstances, the surgeon's inability to reach the brain tumor, the odds they'd been given, the potent chemotherapy treatments he'd undergone, his death shouldn't have come as a surprise, but at that moment, the world had settled into a dull, steady gray that had yet to fade. An hour later, Christina stomped down the stairs faster than she had moved the entire day, brandishing a hairbrush like a conductor's baton. What's the matter? Lindy asked. Tommy was so excited about next week's birthday party. Kool-Aid, cake, ice cream, games, okay? Friday afternoon. She continued vocalizing scattershot thoughts. Her eyes snapped left and right. Let's have the party, okay, Lindy? I don't know why we never thought of it before. The solution is so obvious. She'd fallen asleep crying, smudged tracks of mascara stained her cheeks. Let's celebrate Tommy's birthday, okay, Lindy? Okay? What are you talking about? It doesn't have to be this way, she waved her hands in the air. Honey, he's gone. Lindy swept Christina's hair back from her forehead. But he doesn't have to be. She pulled a patch of Tommy's red hair from the brush and held it between her thumb and index finger. Don't say it, Lindy said. Don't even think it. She put her hands on Christina's shoulders and looked her in the eye. Listen to me. We'll get past this, I promise. Christina pushed her hands away and turned around, looking out the window. I'm not getting past anything. We're bringing him back. As her determination set in, her shaky voice sounded more coherent. Don't you think others have done this? The obituary column gets shorter every day. She spun around and faced her again. For his birthday, Lindy, so we can throw him the party he wanted. Black rivulets began to run down her cheeks again. What kind of parents are we? We can save him, Lindy. We can save him. How can we not? She choked on the final word and sobbed into her hands. It wouldn't be our Tommy, she replied. Although Lindy had steeled herself during Tommy's illness and the burial, she found her lower lip quivering. And we couldn't do that to another child's parents. With their snatcher, they could snatch themselves another Tommy. He's dead. That's it. Christina's face grew stern, and she paused for a long while before speaking again. Then all at once, her grave expression melted. "I'm sorry, Lindy." She sighed and collapsed onto the living room couch. "It's just so hard." Lindy sat down next to her. "I understand." "I know you're right," Christina said. "I know we'll find a way to get past this." She wiped at the corner of her eyes with the sleeve of her flannel nightgown. Lindy patted her thigh. "Do you want anything?" Christina asked. She stood up and headed toward the swinging door to the kitchen. Lindy shook her head and stared at the framed picture on the coffee table of the three of them in Maui, she and Christina and Tommy, all in their bathing suits, sporting yellow leis and broad smiles. Tommy wore Lindy's sunglasses. She felt like an overstretched rubber band. A minute ago she'd been on the verge of tears, but now she found herself smiling. A blue disc materialized in midair, and a tanned arm with blood-red fingernails snaked out of it. It snatched the framed photograph and retreated back into the portal. "God damn it, not that picture," Lindy thought. If she just had another second to react, she would have stabbed the goddamn hand with a fork. A shriek cut through the silence. Lindy leapt from the couch and ran into the kitchen. The door to the garage was wide open. No, she hadn't, Lindy thought. She didn't. Lindy ran to the garage and was confronted with the sight of Christina leaning over the snatcher. She had pulled Tommy halfway out. His skin was blue-white, and he wore the navy blue suit in which they had buried him. He was unmistakably dead. Christina continued to wail. "Let go," Lindy grabbed her arms. "Let him go." Christina released her grip, and the cadaver dropped, disappearing into the ethereal blue mist that wafted out of the snatcher. Her hands shaking, Christina placed the metal lid back on the snatcher and then removed it again. Lindy tried to pull her away from the device, but Christina surprised her with a shove that sent her sprawling to the floor. Christina reached into the snatcher and soon had another variant of Tommy in her grasp, which she tugged upwards. Before long, she cradled another corpse, this one more decomposed than the first, but still outfitted in the same navy blue suit, and let out a high-pitched screech. "For God's sake, stop it," Lindy said. Christina dropped the body back into the snatcher and turned the red dial on the side all the way right. On her third attempt, she leaned in and pulled out a red-faced Tommy clad in polka-dotted pajamas. "What's happening?" he screamed, slapping at her arms. Christina laughed and kissed his cheeks and hugged him tight. Tommy began to cry. "It's okay, baby. Your mommies are here." Christina rocked him in her arms in an exaggerated motion. Lindy moved toward them and grabbed the boy around the waist, prying him from Christina's embrace. "What are you doing?" Christina said. Lindy carried him back over the mouth of the snatcher and tried to jam him back in. But the boy wailed and splayed his legs, his feet catching on the sides of the snatcher. "Mommy," he sobbed. He wrapped his arms around Lindy's neck. "Mommy." She stopped struggling. "Tommy," Lindy said. She hugged him back. "Shh. It's okay. It's okay." As Lindy led him back to his room for the bedtime story, Tommy stopped to put on a stray birthday hat, then diverted them to the bathroom. He insisted on brushing his teeth again before going back to sleep, a classic stalling tactic for sure, but she saw no harm in it. She held Tommy from behind while he perched on a stool and brushed his teeth, peering into the bathroom mirror. She took the toothbrush out of his left hand and moved it to his right hand. "Why can't we read Thunder Bears?" He drooled toothpaste into the sink when he spoke. "We'll read it another night," she lied. "Just pick another book." He shifted the toothbrush back into his left hand and continued brushing. "Use your other hand, honey. It'll be easier." But when Lindy tried to remove the toothbrush from his left hand again, he pulled away and continued brushing. "No, Mommy." Lindy focused on the smooth, effortless movements as Tommy brushed up and down with his left hand. And all at once, the hairs on her arm stood on end. She had allowed herself to forget, just for a few minutes, that this boy was not her son. Tommy, her Tommy, was right-handed. She took a step backward. He rinsed and raced to the bedroom. "I'll get the book." Lindy felt dizzy. Her heart raced. She needed another whiff of Inbliss. Staggering after the boy, she stood at the doorway to his bedroom, Tommy's bedroom, and watched the imposter sort through the books, Tommy's books, on the bottom shelf. "I can't find Thunder Bears," he whined. "Huh?" The words barely registered. Her Tommy deserved better than this, she thought. He deserved to be remembered, to be mourned. "I want you to read me Thunder Bears," Look, just go to sleep, she said. You promised. He started to cry. I want Thunder Bears. For a split second, the boy stopped weeping. He winced and brought his hands to his temples. Then the bawling grew louder. What's the matter? My head hurts, he said, sobbing. Lindy gasped. Her heart pounded. She leaned back against the wall and found herself sliding to the floor. She stared up at the light fixtures in the ceiling, which were spinning, spinning. Tommy continued crying for his book, his hands on the sides of his head, until Lindy crawled over to him. She lifted him up and lay him down in the bed. Shh, it's okay, baby. Mommy's here. She held him in her arms, massaging his forehead. No, 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 she thought. We can't go through this again. Not again. After a minute, he cried himself to sleep. She set him down on the bed. The entire room was spinning now. She stared at her hands. They seemed to move independently from her body, clutching the soft pillow. She moved it an inch away from his face and held it there for a few seconds. What are you doing? Christina said from the doorway. Lindy jumped to her feet, dropping the pillow. Christina's eyes widened. Her face flushed. Lindy staggered past her and down the stairs. As she opened the front door, Christina shouted from the top of the stairway, What were you doing? Lindy slammed the door behind her. Lindy drove several blocks to the beach and stayed awake all night in the pickup truck, staring at the ink-black sky. Not a single star was visible behind the dark thundercloud cover. The rhythmic swoosh of the distant waves reminded her of Tommy's final raspy breaths at the hospital. She blinked, and the sky suddenly grayed. A sickly dawn had arrived, illuminating the garbage-strewn sands. She drove back home and parked at the curbside. After half an hour, she found the energy to sleepwalk down the gravel pathway to the porch of their house, ice cold, numb. What had she almost done? Christina would forgive her anything, she always thought, but this. As Lindy moved past the living room window, she caught a glimpse of two figures inside. There, on the couch, watching cartoons, lay Tommy, and Christina sat next to him. Van Gogh's Starry Night hung on the wall behind them. And all at once, a tremendous wave of relief washed over her, as if yesterday had been nothing more than a drug-induced nightmare, and today she'd been slapped awake to a brand new, shiny reality. Maybe Christina felt the same way. Maybe they could both find a way to get past this. This time, she thought, the doctors would catch the tumor early. This time, he'd be okay. She'd be a good mother to him. Lindy knew now she'd somehow find a way to adjust, to accept the new Tommy as her own. Dear Annabelle was right. They lived in a different world now. As she walked toward the front door, Lindy got a full view of the living room. Her heart froze. A third person, a woman, sat next to Christina, thigh against thigh, laughing along with them. The woman got up and walked behind the couch and tickled Tommy from behind, catching him off guard. As Tommy squealed, Christina also shrieked with laughter. The woman was Lindy. Lindy stepped back from the window and staggered down the walkway. She tripped and fell to her knees, crawling to the pickup truck. There she fumbled for the inhaler in the glove compartment and took a hit. The sky, the world, was spinning. And as quietude gradually enveloped her, she imagined an outstretched arm appearing in midair, white and smooth and smelling of Christina's perfume, reaching down to take her hand and pull her up through the patch of cobalt blue sky to a different place, a place where she belongs. She took another deep whiff.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills, sketch the trees and the daffodils. Catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land. Now I understand
what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now.
You've just been listening to Mercurio de Rivera reading Snatch Me Another from his collection Across the Event Horizon. This, of course, is Don McLean.
Reflect in Vincent's eyes of china blue, colors changing hue, morning fields of amber grain, weathered faces lined in pain are soothed beneath the artist's loving hand. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now, for they could not love you. Still your love was true. And when no hope was left inside on that starry, starry night, you took your life as lovers often do. But I could have told you, Vincent, this world was never meant for one as beautiful. Starry, starry night, portraits hung in empty halls, frameless heads on nameless walls, with eyes that watch the world and can't forget, like the strangers that you've met, the ragged men in ragged silver thorn, a bloody rose, I crushed and broken on the virgin snow.
Okay, well, it's a lovely version, but it's the live version, so it goes on and on. But it's a nice song, Don McLean's Starry Night. I thought it was an appropriate...
Well chosen, Jim. It fits the story perfectly.
A good segue.
Yes.
That's one of your creepier stories, really. But as I was saying, it's disturbing. But it's not the kind of disturbance that that causes direct nightmares. You know, it's very dreamlike,
well,
actually,
I'll,
to begin
I'll tell
with.
You, one thing that was an inspiration was, I don't know if you remember the classic Twilight Zone episode. I don't remember the name of it, but it's the one where the woman is waiting at the bus station and she catches a glimpse of a doppelganger of herself.
Is that that's not one with Vera Miles, is it?
You know, I don't remember the actress.
Yeah.
But I know that at the end the woman is replaced. And
I thought,
my gosh, that idea is terrifying, of somebody taking over your life and replacing you that way.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. And it's a little bit bisonic if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Except that in this case, it's yours.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, I think that, I don't know what the name of the genre is, but the two of you are in the same one.
I've always thought of it as just classic science fiction, but...
it is. It is. I mean, it's also Bradbury-esque. It's the kind of thing that he might have done. If you think of, what was it, Marionettes Incorporated is a story that sort of fits into that same kind of a genre. It definitely does harken back to 50s and 60s short story anthologies, which were my favorites.
Mm.
the kind of things that you read in Galaxy magazine, FNSF, and Astounding / Analog, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I've been told that my stories are similar to these classic SF-type genre stories, and some people might be insulted by that. I think it's a compliment. I think those stories are fun and entertaining.
Yeah.
And it's all about just an interesting idea and entertaining. And I like to always have a strong emotion in the story as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it comes through there.
Yeah.
Clearly, some time has passed since you wrote these stories and the publication date. So what have you been doing and what are you working on now?
I have a couple of things that are forthcoming. I have a novella that's in the works with Immersion Press. It's a standalone hardcover novella called Free Fall, and it involves my aliens, the Worgens. I have a whole series of stories involving the Worgens, these aliens who instantly fall in love with any human being that they see and want to just help humans and be with humans. And humans, of course, are repulsed by them but want their technology. Therein lies the dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
So it's set in that universe, and the whole story, the whole novella, is told in free fall. Soldiers free fall from outer space onto the core of a gas giant, and the entire story is told in different strata of the atmosphere as they plummet.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite a challenge, and I'm very proud of it, and it's due out next month with Immersion Press.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
And that's a standalone.
It's a standalone.
Okay.
Yeah, and that same publisher, by the way, published Elliot de Bedard and Levi Tadar. And both were nominated for, well, Elliot was nominated for a Hugo for
that's right.
last year.
That's right.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that officially. Yeah.
Yeah.
I congratulated you off air about that, but on air.
Right. Well, I mean, Elliot was nominated. I haven't been nominated for anything like that. But.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. But forthcoming.
Yes.
Hopefully the you haven't been nominated for anything yet?
I was nominated for the World Fantasy Award.
That's okay.
Yes, yes, yes. For Tu Sufrimiento Shall Protect Us, a story that's also in this collection.
Yeah.
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 And by the way, Jim, I have a story forthcoming, a collaboration with E.C. Myers.
Ooh.
Yes, which is very interesting. He is a young adult writer. He just won the Norton Award.
That's right.
And our styles are very different, so...
I was so pleased and amazed. I took a look at the Hugos this year. Like, what's coming... it was the Nebulas.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Nebulas this year. And I thought, yeah, okay, it's all predictable. And then I saw E.C. Myers' Eugene. And I just went, yes!
I think the whole industry just went, yes.
I think so.
He's so beloved.
Yeah. Yeah, he really is. Yeah. Just, you know, he's a great person. He's a good writer. And another traitor. Although Philadelphia isn't that far. Somebody actually, by the way, one writer actually messaged me during the program saying, "You called me a traitor. What do I have to do?" And I you know, come to New York and be on the show. I said, yes, and move back to New York. So that's it.
What do you get when you cross a young adult writer like Eugene and a classic science fiction writer like myself?
Gee, I don't know, David. What do you
get? You get a story about sex parties and body swapping.
Okay.
So that story will be appearing in Space and Time magazine, hopefully in the next 6 months.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah. How long ago did you sell it to Space and Time?
Oh, about 9 months ago.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say Hildy Silverman, mm-hmm. the fine editor of Space and Time magazine, has a backlist of stories that a lot of people are saying, yes, it's coming out in Space and Time. I think she's actually closed to submissions now
mm-hmm.
until she can get that backlist.
Right, right. Oh, and one other thing, Jim, we have... I have a story appearing in Zombies, Shambling Across the Ages, which is a prime book anthology
right.
edited by Steve Berman. And
there's that name again. Everybody who's been coming here, Rick Bowes, Lethe Press, Steve Berman, and Catherine Lundell comes on, and she has a book from Berman. And
mm-hmm.
Berman, when you another Philadelphian. When are you coming on the show again? There was one time he missed three. We had three shows set up, and he missed three in a row.
Wow.
One was a horrible snowstorm. Another one was just, I think he was just too depressed, you know. he was having trouble in his life at that point, you know.
Right, right.
You know, it's not like I'm divulging any secret that he didn't blog about.
Well, you know, that the concept of that anthology, by the way, is famous historical events with zombies.
That works. That works for me quite well, as a matter of fact.
By the way, Paul Berger and Raj Khanna from my writing group also have stories in that collection. So,
oh, cool!
It's a party.
Yeah, there's an editor in that group who used to put out a series of anthologies that, you know, drew from that group strongly. Sybil's Garage, edited by Matt Gressel. But we haven't seen.
I read much slush for Sybil's.
Oh, you were a slusher for that.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
I have to do another slush show.
Mm.
I was a slusher for Galaxy Magazine.
Okay.
When Jim Bain was the editor and Spider Robinson. Jim Bain, Spider Robinson, and I were the entire staff of Galaxy Magazine. That was bizarre. And, you know, I was the gopher. And,
well, you know, to any aspiring writer, read slush. I mean, it's what an instructional tool that is.
It really is. You learn immediately all the don't dare do this or that. And by the way, Ahmad, don't fall asleep. You're on the air in like four and a half minutes. So, I'm telling everybody, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper. Are you calling it that? With Ahmad Ali filling in for Lister. And when the first time I mentioned that and Matt Kressel was here, he hears the name Lister. He goes, what? Red Dwarf? No, a different Lister. this is the one from Island Records and WUSB, where Ahmad is also yeah, exactly. Well, it's impossible to believe, but we're based. This show's over.
Wow, seems like we just got started.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, it was short enough when I was 2 hours. You hear me, Andrew? And now that it's 90 minutes, it's fleeting. It just, you know, moves on by. Mm. So in the background, silently, but the outro music has begun. I said you're going to go on time. And we have to remind people that the book is called Across the Event Horizon. And it is
it's available on, you know, BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com and at my website, MercurioRivera.com.
I say to everybody, go to MercurioRivera.com. You know, get it from the source. And that way, you know, I like that the best. And then you can choose your vendor of choice. And we should mention that is MercurioRivera.com. Yeah, because it's radio, and people don't always see the subtitles that we have going. I shouldn't say that joke anymore, because now on HD radio, they actually can do that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's very bizarre. So thank you all for listening. Thank you, Mercurio, for being here. David, I should say.
Thank you, Jim, for having me. It's always fun, and hopefully next time I'll bring the writers group with me.
Yes, I would like. We need to do another one of those. And
well, we have a couple of new members, so we can put them on the block.
Oh, very, very good.
Yeah.
Any of them doctors?
Yes.
I had a feeling.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, again, I'll be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m., I trust and hope. In the meantime, everybody take care and visit the website, ourwolf.com, and stay tuned to WBAI for Ahmad Ali coming your way in moments. Good morning.
WBAI New York. She just finished the show over at the Bitter End a few hours ago. Memnahader. This is Ahmed Ali filling in for filling in for Lister Hewinlow.
Second year, love, nothing happens. could hear even more love. Nothing happens. Fourth year, fifth year, even more love. And then, maybe not.
Nueve punto cinco, that's right. 99.5 right here on Burn Baby Burn, that's right.
I'm struggling along the road. I'm so all alone with my heavy load. Just treading on from dusk till dawn, searching to find my happy, happy home. And I know someday I'll surely reach my destination, where we live into
be some good clean civilization. So set me free from captivity and stop from dealing with partiality. Cause every man has a right to be free, but some of us, yet they just can't see that we are living in a world of temptation. And it seems someone cast a spell upon our nation. Yeah. Surely reach my destination, where we live into some good clean civilization. So set me free from captivity and stop from dealing with brutality. Yeah, every man has a right to be free, but some of us, yet they just can't see that we are living in a world of temptation. And it seems someone cast a spell upon our nation.